What's good, y'all? Your boy Brandon back again. Another episode of the On Run podcast, man. I got Alfredo and Noah in the studio with me today. And today we're welcoming in Emma here joining us, who is a dietitian by profession. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. I'm excited for this conversation.
So yeah, I'm a registered dietitian. I've worked for Desert Dietitians for 7 years. I originally got interested in nutrition a very long time ago in high school. I think that our food system and our culture's view on nutrition is very interesting and unique.
Why do you say that?
It's something that is a field of research, and yet we all eat food. So we all have our own personal experience with food and how it affects us on our body. And for that reason, there is a plethora of information out there and anecdotal evidence that I think needs to be taken into account. And then in addition, we also have a large fixation on diet culture and how food can affect body composition. And this can lead to some pretty complex relationships with food that we can get into later on in the episode, kind of the interplay between like our human biology, how our brain, our lower brain has been conditioned to kind of seek out food versus our diet culture kind of trying to restrict our food choices. And then kind of how nutrition plays into health overall. And sometimes diet culture and a healthy diet don't always align. It's not always cohesive. So it's a very complex topic. I've always been interested in it, and I've been exploring it for the past 10 years.
Yeah, it's a very interesting conversation. We had a UFC fighter on a few episodes ago, and we were kind of going through everything he's learned, you know, being in a profession where you are required to shed a lot of weight very fast, and how fast nutrition has evolved, how the science of nutrition has evolved, where in the past you would see the typical, you know, if you're trying to, you know, get in the gym or get right, it's like you wake up every day, you eat a raw egg, or, you know, you blend some nails in and then drink it or whatever. Whereas like now we're understanding that, you know, there's a specific way to eat depending on your body composition and your desired goals, and as well as the psychological relationship that people have with food. Is that correct?
100%. 100%. I mean, wow. If you look at the nutrition advice that was doled out 30 years ago, it's laughable. Like, if you guys ever watch YouTube videos of bodybuilders back in the day, they're like, egg whites, just protein powder mixed with water, low fat, everything. Now we're super, super low carb. Mm-hmm. We're very, you know, fat is good for us. Fat is good for our hormones. So we're constantly kind of going from one end of the spectrum to the other with nutrition. I hope that now the research is evolving to try to cultivate a type of balance, but nutrition is a very young field of research. It's only existed for 100 years. Just to put that into context, math has existed for like thousands and thousands of years.
Of course.
We just started looking into nutrition during World War II when soldiers were having nutrient deficiencies. We finally found the correlation between, oh, the food that we eat has vitamins, and if we give soldiers these vitamins, it can help to prevent these nutrient deficiency diseases. That's when the field of nutrition was finally born. And so it's no wonder that we are still figuring it out.
Yeah, and it makes sense. And I guess it went from, you know, knowing that vitamins and all these nutrients in food have a positive effect, or it's a required effect on the body. It went really quick from, you know, being in that to sort of trying to figure out how to optimize and how to, like, what vitamins and nutrients do you need to get this result and that result? Kind of like the Captain America movie where, you know, they're giving them this serum to make them like super strong and super fast and stuff. I guess the field of nutrition quickly went to that, but because it was so young, people kind of just started guessing, and you know, of course, different people have different results, and if it works for one guy, it's like, no, it worked for him. So like everybody has to do it, when I guess that's not really the case, right?
100%. It's absolutely a one size fits one approach. There are some things that I think benefits us all to look out for in nutrition, but just because one diet really worked for somebody does not mean it's going to work for another person. I try to never demonize a certain diet because, in my opinion, if somebody feels really good the way that they're eating and it's supportive to their health, then I'm on board for it. Whether it's like raw vegan or carnivore, just do it in a healthy way.
That makes sense. Mm-hmm. Why do you think the conversations have evolved into such, to place such a high specificity and emphasis on just counting calories?
Well, because the thermodynamic principle of calories in, calories out, it still holds true to this day. However, that's such a simple phrase for such a complex process. Yes, calories in, calories out are important, but you're missing some pieces there. Your hormone health. You could be eating very low calories, but if your hormones are off, it's going to make it really, really challenging to lose weight. I've seen people that are eating 500, 600 calories a day, and if they eat anything more than that, they start to put on weight.
Wow.
I blew past that.
So, and this is because we need to factor in something called metabolic adaptation. So let's back it up a bit.
Sure.
Let's talk about our biology for a second. Okay. So thousands of years ago, the humans that were able to retain weight are the ones that survived. The humans that were driven to eat as much as they could, as fast as they could, and choose the highest calorie foods, they're the ones that survived. So we are the descendants of the people that retained weight and craved those foods because those were the ones that survived the famine, right? Mm-hmm. So on a biological level, humans are just primed to try to hold on to weight and to crave high calorie foods. Now we are in a society where we have an excess of options when it comes to high calorie foods. But we still have the brain that has evolved, or we still have the brain that hasn't really evolved too much from that time period thousands of years ago.
So that leads us to really be very dependent on calories, 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 when in reality, the world is much more complex now. The world evolved, but our brain hasn't really changed much since back then.
Our brain has not. And so now we're living in a world where people are intentionally trying to lose weight. And so our brain will set off a series of mechanisms in order to prevent us from losing weight. This is called metabolic adaptation. So some of the ways that our brain will try to slow our weight loss is by lowering our metabolism. Mm. It does this by slowing our heart rate. Your heart burns so many calories a day. It's a constantly active muscle. So if you just slow your heart rate by like a fraction of a second, that will significantly reduce the amount of calories that you're burning. It also will impact your thyroid. So for some people, when they're losing weight, they'll notice that their thyroid hormone decreases. This is because your brain is communicating to your thyroid, hey, we're starving. We need to dampen down our metabolism because your thyroid is kind of the thermostat of your metabolism. If your thyroid hormones go up, your metabolism ranks up. If they go down, it starts to dampen down. Your brain may also target muscle mass to be utilized for energy. Now, there's a way around this. We can talk about that, but it will target muscle mass because your muscle burns a lot of calories. Compared to fat tissue, your muscle burns like 27 calories per kilogram, while fat tissue only burns 5 calories per kilogram of body weight. So it may start to take away from your muscle, and that will also start to reduce your metabolism. So when people are in a calorie deficit, yeah, you'll lose weight, but you need to be mindful of your metabolism because you'll get to a point where you will plateau. right? If I'm in a calorie deficit, I don't just waste away into nothing. Mm-hmm. Eventually, I hit that plateau. And that is when your deficit has now become your maintenance. And that's because your brain has effectively reduced your metabolic burn throughout the day. And so, yes, calorie deficit, but also make sure that your metabolism is good. And there's some ways that we can actually do that. There's some ways that we can actually prioritize our metabolism during the weight loss process, which I think cannot be overlooked.
So the ways you prioritize your metabolism, is would that be through the types of food you eat? Is it through activities you can do or through medications you can take or all the above?
Yeah, there's quite a few ways that we could do it. So your metabolism, do you want me to kind of go into like what makes
Yeah, what
up
really
your metabolism?
Is a metabolism? Because yeah. That's a word that all the weight loss gurus will talk yeah. about. Everybody like hears it, but nobody really knows what it really is.
I just know when I get older, it's going to slow down. That's all they tell me.
No, mine is already slowing down. Mine's already slowing down.
Yeah, but you're older. That's
the thing. Yeah, no, don't do that. Hold on. I'm not that much older than y'all. I'm just letting y'all know.
You said it over.
Yeah.
So. Yes, metabolism, it's a word that's thrown around all the time, but what does that actually mean? It basically means like all of the energy burning processes in your body. Every single chemical reaction in your body that is using up energy, that's your metabolism. Your metabolism is made up of three parts. 70% of what you're burning throughout the day is coming from your basal metabolic rate, your BMR. Your BMR is basically the amount of calories that you would burn if you were in a coma, okay? So keeps your heart rate pumping, keeps your lungs working. Take out physical activity completely. If you're just lying in bed all day,
like the base
you're
level.
Still burning calories, right? Mm-hmm. That's 70%. 70% of your metabolism is that. So that's a pretty good one to focus on if you are trying to increase your metabolism, right? Because it makes up a huge chunk of the pie. One of the best ways that we can do this is through increasing our lean body tissue. Mm. So I think that, you know, everybody kind of has an idea of this now, but muscle burns more calories than fat, right? We hear this all the time. Very important for us to prioritize building up our muscle and building up our bone density. Because these are living, active tissues that burn a lot of calories throughout the day. So if I took two people that weighed the same amount, but one person had significantly higher muscle mass, their metabolism would be significantly higher. They would be burning significantly more calories throughout the day. So how do we increase our muscle mass and our bone mass? Resistance training. Regular resistance training, lifting weights, is probably the best way that you are going to be able to build up your muscle mass. And this is really beneficial in a calorie deficit because, like I said, your brain might try to target your muscle and go, hey, let me take some of this. This is burning a lot of calories. I'm trying to reduce the metabolism. It's not going to do that if you're working the muscle, right? The brain basically goes, hey, body, I need to take calories from somewhere. Heart, can I take it from you? And the heart's like, absolutely not. I need it. I've been doing a lot of work. I work all day, every day. It'll say, hey, muscle, can I take it from you? If you're not working your muscle, yeah, it's going to take it. But if you've been working it, the muscle's going to say, no, I've been putting in the work. I kind of need this. And the brain goes, okay, fine. I'll take it from the fat.
So it's like the last resource. The fat is.
Essentially. I mean, it's a lot more complex than that, but yeah. We could say just for like colloquial terms, yes.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I mean, it's a shitty design. So pivoting out of that a little bit, to go along with that, right, the emphasis on counting calories and the obsession between calories in, calories out, and the oversimplification, I think another thing that has been really forced into general population, especially in America, has been like the fad diets. So like the keto diet, all these different types of diets where it's like, you can only eat this food, don't eat that food. And people swear by them so much. And then other people are like, yeah, I tried it and it doesn't work. Or the other problem people have is they'll try it and it works. But then as soon as you get off of it, the results go away and you actually might even end up worse than you were before. Why do you think that is?
Okay, so it has to do with that metabolic adaptation. Because if you are eating in a calorie deficit, your metabolism is going to go down. And so with these fad diets, there's not really a lot of magic to them. They usually just put you into a calorie deficit. And so if you can't sustain that type of lifestyle, and then you get off of that dietary pattern and you go back to living the way that you were, your metabolism has already been damaged. And so people experience something called like, or they experience a scenario where they say, oh, I gained all the weight back plus some. You hear that all the time. That's because of this metabolic adaptation. You were unable to sustain the deficit and therefore you gained it all back plus a little bit more. We want to make sure that when we're losing weight, we're doing it at a slow rate, like no more than 2 pounds a week, ideally, because if you crash diet and you really damage your metabolism and you can't sustain it, there's a really good chance that weight loss is not going to be for the long term. There's two other factors that kind of go along with this. These are the two other parts of your metabolism. So 70% comes from the BMR, which we can increase through muscle mass. Two others are going to be the thermic effect of food. So the thermic effect of food and then physical activity. Let's talk about the thermic effect of food first. The thermic effect of food is basically this idea that when you are digesting food, it's actually burning a lot of energy, right? So different foods have a different amount of energy burn. If I eat candy, it doesn't really take a lot of energy for me to digest that. It's made out of simple sugars. We don't need a lot of enzymes to kind of break that down. It's absorbed super quickly. Pretty much, if I'm eating 100 calories of candy, I'm probably netting about 100 calories. If I'm eating 100 calories of chicken breast, though, we need to do a lot of mechanical work to break that down. We have to chew it. Our stomach has to work really hard to break it down. We have all these enzymes that need to go in there in our small intestine to break it apart into tiny, tiny amino acids in order for it to be absorbed. So if you're eating 100 calories of chicken breast, you're actually only netting like 70 calories of it. So this is why people, when they're on, say, like, you know, a high protein diet, they may say, oh, calories don't matter. They do, though. They do. Even though, like, on MyFitnessPal, it seems like they're eating, like, much higher calories, they're not netting that, okay? So typically when people are having, like, whole foods diets, they think, oh, the calories don't matter, just eat whole foods. The calories do matter, but because you're eating whole foods, high fiber, high protein, those are the ones that have the highest thermic effect. You're probably burning a lot just by digesting them alone. So that's another part of metabolism that we have to keep in mind. Finally, physical activity, that makes up 20%. So thermic effect 10, BMR 70, physical activity 20%. This is when exercise comes into play, right? Everybody always says, you know, diet, 80% diet, 20% exercise. I don't believe that. I think it's 50-50. When you look at the best health outcomes that people have, they exercise. When you look at people that can actually sustain 30 pounds of weight loss for 3 years or more, 95% of them are working out for at least an hour a day. So that's pretty significant.
Who are the other 5%?
They're working out for probably 30 minutes a day. Oh, okay. You know what I mean?
Same thing.
So it's very, very important for us to prioritize good exercise. And then also, like I said, for the BMR, resistance training should be very much included in that. But it's not just about what you do in the gym. There's another thing that has popped up in recent literature. It's called non-exercise activity thermogenesis, NEAT. Have you guys heard of that before?
No.
Okay.
Wait, our pay grade. Yeah. Non-exercise
activity thermogenesis. So he's doing it right now.
Oh, like shaking your leg. Like, that's what. Like, he's just nervous.
Are you working out right now?
So we, you know, those people right that like they can eat a ton and they just don't really seem to put on weight.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
We think that they may have high levels of non-exercise activity thermogenesis because they just kind of are constantly burning calories throughout the day just by fidgeting. You know, they kick their leg, they're like twiddling with something. They can be more spastic with their movements. Non-exercise activity thermogenesis is unconscious, so they can't control it. And we can't, like, kind of force ourselves to do it. But it does give credence to the fact that if you take the time to just work in physical activity throughout the day, it does compound on itself and it does build up. So I feel like you hear all the time, like, park farther away in the parking lot, take the stairs instead of the escalator. And you're like, what the heck is this doing? Like, is this really making a difference?
She's not lying, because when I was at UNLV, I used to walk around everywhere. I was skinny as shit.
Yes.
And now, since I got a corporate job, I just sit on
work
my ass.
From home.
The... Yeah, working from home. Kill me, dog. I'm about to get my master's. Fuck this.
Don't even get it. Just walk around.
Yeah, just walk around.
Yeah.
Pick up trash.
You're right. Yeah.
More affordable.
Yeah. No, you're right. You're right.
Yes. So yeah. So those are all the parts of metabolism and, you know, metabolic adaptation. Very much an important thing. But you were talking about fad diets, so I wanted to go back to that because I know I kind of deviated from that for a sec.
Well, just to close off that topic, I guess it makes sense because 70% of it is the resting metabolic rate at which you're burning calories and your body's using the fuel.
Yeah.
But exercise is going to then feed into that as well. So I guess that's where people have to understand, like, it is 50-50, because that part also, if, you know, the more muscle mass you have, boom, which you're going to get from exercising is going to go into that. So full circle. But
not only that, but exercise also plays into our hormonal health as well. It affects our appetite hormones. It affects our insulin sensitivity. It affects our leptin sensitivity. So we could definitely dive into the ways that exercise can also kind of affect us at a hormonal level and talk about how hormones can play into weight management as well.
Which, and a psychological level as well, right?
100%. 100%. It's really good for your mental health. And like I always say, we all kind of know how to eat healthy. We all kind of know the things that we're supposed to do, but we don't always do that. We don't always make the healthy choice for ourselves. And mental health can play a huge role in that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, going back to the fad diets, I guess, why have they become so ingrained, such a big part of like the nutrition culture? Obviously not the scientific part, but like the societal part.
That's a great question. I think one part of it is people just want easy answers for this. You know, the sucky part about being a dietitian is there is a lot of gray area. It's hard for me to speak in absolutes. Like, I can't say that red meat is 100% bad for you.
Right.
But people like to hear that because they just want clear answers. And nutrition is in a field where you can really give a lot of clear answers. It's very nuanced. And so I think that definitely plays a role. And then I think humans just kind of have like a tribe mentality. And you see that in fad diet culture,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, the carnivore diet. Everybody was posting that wooden board with a steak and avocado.
Yes.
Like kiwis.
Yeah, people's breakfast was just steak. I'm like, damn, bro.
All right. FYI, cutting boards are, like, so impractical to, like, have steak on because, like, the juice falls off the side.
It
gets
off
on the carpet. You're like, this sucks.
Yeah.
Use a plate like a normal person. sorry. But, people kind of use nutrition as like a form of doctrine now. They're like, they like religiously hold themselves to it. And there's like a lot of morality around food. Like, this is good, this is bad. If you eat this way, you're a morally good person. If you eat this way, then you're a morally bad person. And so I think that plays into it as well.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But let's go ahead and dispel, I guess, or let's give a more of a comprehensive answer, which you were gracious enough to share with us before we started recording. You developed your own like 5-pillar framework as to how we can achieve not only nutritional health, but hormonal health and just be a well-rounded human overall. What are you calling it?
Yes. So this is a model that I came up with called the five pillars of metabolic health. The five pillars of metabolic health include hormone health, gut health, the calorie deficit, metabolism maintenance, and mindful eating. So if you'd like, I could kind of go into them.
Yes, let's do it.
I'm going to check off in my head. I'm like, okay.
Which one is it?
The reason why I put this together is because I meet with a lot of people that are trying to pursue weight management, and I have found that people can't lose weight for different reasons, and it's usually due to one of these five pillars. So let's start with hormones. So hormones are chemical messengers in the body that have very profound impacts on your metabolism, your energy levels, your ability to sleep, the whole nine yards. If your hormones are imbalanced, it makes it really, really tricky to facilitate any type of weight management. Your body is just simply not in a state to be able to do that. There are many, many hormones that influence our metabolism. We all know, like, our sex hormones, estrogen and testosterone, obviously have a role in reproductive health, but they also influence our metabolism very significantly. Other ones to keep out a lookout for would be your thyroid hormones. Like I said earlier, your thyroid is kind of the thermostat of your metabolism. So if you crank up the thyroid hormones, your metabolism is going to go up. If you crank them down, your metabolism is going to go down. There's something called hypothyroidism, which can be caused by a variety of things. But basically, low thyroid hormone means that you may struggle with weight loss because your body is unable to access the fat and carbohydrate stores, which can then lead to fatigue, low energy, cold intolerance, and the like. So hypothyroidism, that's a big one. If you have that, then making sure that your thyroid's hormones become balanced is essential for you to have really effective weight loss. There's cortisol, a stress hormone released by the adrenal glands. When people have high cortisol, it can be really tricky for them to lose weight. Cortisol, it puts the body under a lot of stress, a lot of inflammation. It makes it really hard for them to sleep. Poor sleep usually leads to poor eating choices. And in addition, cortisol activates an enzyme called lipoprotein lipase, which is an enzyme that stores fat in the body. So when you have a lot of cortisol circulating around, you're just kind of in a fat storing mode. And then we also have insulin. Insulin is a hormone that helps to drive down your blood sugar. Think of your cells, like your cells all need sugar. They need the sugar for the energy. But even though they're hungry and you have sugar in your blood, their doors aren't going to open unless they have a key, and that key is insulin, okay? But over time, our cells can actually develop a tolerance to insulin. So even though we may have insulin in the body, our cells aren't responding, the doors aren't opening. This insulin resistance drives a lot of metabolic disorders. It drives PCOS, it drives diabetes. And insulin is kind of like cortisol. It's more of like a fat-storing hormone. It's called an anabolic hormone, so it's good for like building tissues. It's also good for building fat tissue. So trying to make sure that our insulin levels are at a lower range is going to be optimal for fat loss. In addition, we want to keep track of our, well, I don't really measure these hormones, but these are just good ones to be aware of. Your appetite hormones. So ghrelin is your hunger hormone. And then there are leptin, peptide YY, and glucagon-like peptide 1, aka GLP-1. Those are your fullness hormones, okay? So learning how you can utilize different lifestyle measures to try to regulate your appetite can be very helpful for weight management for obvious reasons, I'm sure.
Yeah, and we'll circle back to GLP-1 because that's definitely a topic we want to touch on. But going back a little bit, cortisol, obviously everybody kind of knows insulin resistance, like yes, diabetes and stuff. But cortisol isn't really spoken about as much. And it's kind of funny because it goes back to the same conversation of our brains not evolving. So it's a stress hormone. So in the past, like, we would have high cortisol because we're going to go to war. We might be surrounded by, like, wild animals. Like, yes. It's actual life and death. Yeah. Now it's like, bro, I just got a work meeting tomorrow, and I'm stressed.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
And now I'm going to go to email. Yeah, so it's like our brain is like, bro, chill. Like, this is an email. Like, nothing's going to happen. But what are some tools to sort of build that resistance to cortisol and overall just, like, decrease your cortisol levels?
Yes, so one of the best ways is, again, I feel like I'm beating a dead horse here, but exercise, simply exercise. Because like you said, we are used to stressors warranting a fight or flight response. And so when you don't give a physical response to your stress, your stress hormones are just going to continue to circulate through your body and just cause a ruckus. What you need to do, think of exercise as a way to naturally complete your stress response. Okay. So think of going to the gym as a way to clear out your stress hormones. That is one of the best ways to get rid of your cortisol. And then also, since it is a stress hormone, trying to practice stress management can be really helpful. When we are chronically stressed, we're not getting enough sleep. This is when our cortisol tends to get too high. So prioritize your sleep and make sure that you're trying to implement some type of practice to regulate your nervous system, calm down your nervous system. It's different for everybody, right? But some common ones would be like breath work, meditation, maybe taking some time to engage in a hobby, getting active. It's very individualized, but that's going to be essential for regulating your cortisol levels.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that's definitely the one I wanted to highlight. But yeah, we can continue with our second pillar.
Okay. Yes. Yes. So our second pillar is gut health. So I'm sure you guys may have come across like info on the gut microbiome before. Yes.
Yeah, I know it's getting popular with like the probiotic sodas, all like the...
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. So kind of a recent discovery, I would say, probably in the past like 10, 15 years, there's been an explosion of research, right? We're realizing, wow, our gut is literally the second brain. People are calling it the enteric nervous system. Enteral stems from like gut. So your gut microbiome is basically a collection of trillions of bacteria that live in your colon. There's three different types of bacteria that we kind of categorize them in. There's like the beneficial bacteria. These are the like synergistic bacteria. We give them a place to live and they have a lot of benefits for us and our health. Then we have commensal bacteria. These are the guys that are just kind of chilling. They may help us out a little bit, but they're not giving us like the big payoff. But they're not causing us any harm either. And then we have parasitic bacteria. So these are bacteria that really do cause us harm. They're a parasite, right? They're using us and they're causing us harm. And so those are the ones that we really want to try to get rid of in our gut. So I see a lot of gut issues in my clients, whether they have like IBS or just some type, they're experiencing like bloating or just like poor bathroom habits. Gut dysbiosis is a real thing, and it's usually caused by an overgrowth of the bad guys and not enough of the good guys. So trying to modify your gut microbiome can help from a digestive perspective, but then we've also realized that your gut microbiome has profound influences on your metabolism. It has profound influences on your immune system and also influences on your mental health as well. So prioritizing a healthy gut is just really, really helpful for full body balance. Your gut actually also significantly interacts with your hormones as well. Your gut actually can recycle hormones back into your body. Wow. That's kind of a cool thing. And then they also may help to synthesize certain gut hormones. glucagon-like peptide 1 released from the gut. Your gut microbiome helps to synthesize that. And remember, that's one of your fullness hormones. So that helps you stay full. So it also can have an impact on your appetite. The best ways to prioritize a healthy gut is to prioritize a whole foods diet with an emphasis on a variety of colored plant foods and lots of different types of fiber. So we want to try to aim for like 30 different plant foods a week, which sounds like a lot, but think about it. If you had a salad with like mixed greens.
I'm just watching his face. He's like, did I eat 30 plants?
I'm like thinking like Cobb salad got one.
I don't think he ate 30 plants the whole year.
Yeah, hold on, 30 different plants. Yeah.
Well, you know, think like nuts, seeds, beans. Like if you get like a typical lettuce mix, there's usually like 4 different like greens in there. So you could kind of add things up. I would say just try to prioritize eating like plenty of fruits and veggies throughout the day and like focus on 30 grams of fiber each day. Mm-hmm. So we want to load up on the good stuff, but then also something that would be beneficial would be to try to avoid the things that are going to harm your gut health too. Yeah. So, you know, it's not just about adding in the good stuff, but it's about avoiding some of the not so good stuff too. Like a lot of processed foods have like additives and emulsifiers that have been shown to impact your gut health in a negative way. Eating a lot of inflammatory foods like added sugars actually supports the growth of the bad bacteria in your gut. There's bacteria that feed on sugar in your gut that will release acid, and that acid can start to erode your gut lining and cause something called leaky gut syndrome, which means that, you know, the stuff from your colon is like mixing with the stuff on the inside of your body, and that triggers your immune system and causes a bunch of inflammation. So it's not so good. Fiber is going to feed the good stuff. And then there's also like a lot of probiotic rich foods. So those are foods that actually have the good bacteria in them. Think Greek yogurt, kimchi, kefir. There's also like probiotic sauerkraut pickles on the market these days. But that'll kind of like plant the seed, and then the fiber will grow a healthy gut microbiome. So that's super important for, again, optimizing your metabolism, your energy, your mental health. It also helps with the hormones. But that's not the only thing that we need to keep in mind.
Let's say your gut microbiome is just like not where it needs to be at all. How long does it take after implementing these changes for you to get to an acceptable level?
Oh, yeah. It takes some time. So I would say anytime you're trying to facilitate like a major change in your body at like a physiological level, give it 3 months at least. That's when you'll start to see some changes. That can be tough. This is why nutrition is so hard, because it's not instant gratification. You do kind of have to put in the work before you see the results. But over time, when you start to choose the right foods and start to avoid some of the more inflammatory foods, your gut will start to change. It just takes a bit of time.
Perfect. Mm-hmm. All right. Yeah. Let's go to the third pillar.
Okay. So this is for my clients that come in and they are like, Emma, I don't understand what I'm doing wrong. I eat so, so clean. I haven't gone out to eat in years. I don't do fast food. I only eat a whole foods diet, but I can't seem to lose weight. This is where the calorie deficit comes in, because peanut butter is a whole food, guys. And I don't know about you, but I could house like half a jar of peanut butter. Like, it's so delicious. It's so good. But that's like probably 2,000 calories worth of peanut butter. So just because we're having a whole foods diet doesn't mean that it's going to be the
end all be all decision maker.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. We need to learn how to portion control. And so in my office, we actually have an indirect calorimeter to test people's metabolism.
That's what you were wondering about yesterday, remember?
Oh, that's what. Okay, yeah, because I was doing my research for this episode yesterday, and like you know, I went on the desert page and like I saw this like machine that like looked like
Bane.
From, Bane from
Batman.
Dark Knight Returns.
Yes, like, yes. Yeah. Do you want me to kind of explain that?
Please, yes.
How does it work? Yeah.
Okay, so that's an indirect calorimeter. An indirect calorimeter is the gold standard in nutrition science for metabolism measurement. So what it does is basically it measures your respiratory rate, and from that it can estimate your metabolic rate. Now, that might be a little confusing because, like, what does my breathing have to do with my metabolism? Well, let's get into the physiology of it. So whenever we eat food, we can't immediately use that food for energy. Right. The calories that we get from food cannot be used for cellular energy. We need to convert the food energy into cellular energy. And in order to do this, we need oxygen. Okay, this is called cellular respiration if you want to look it up. So that's where the oxygen comes in. And this is why when you don't have oxygen, your tissues die because your cells are unable to utilize energy. Okay. Then whenever we are burning off energy through like glycolysis or beta oxidation or proteolysis, the like, what's given off is carbon dioxide. So whenever you're burning energy, you're literally breathing it out as a byproduct. Okay. So that's where the respiratory rate comes in. This machine can take your respiratory rate and use it to estimate your basal metabolic rate, right? That resting metabolic rate. And from there, I could take that number and really figure out how much energy you are burning throughout the day based on the amount of physical activity that you report to me. It's much more precise than using a formula, because I'm sure maybe all of us have ventured to the internet and gone, how many calories am I burning in a day? And it says, what's your height? What's your weight? What's your age?
That BMI calculator.
And then like you try 10 different ones, they all give you 10 different answers.
100%. 100%. They're using formulas, but we all don't fall in the middle of the bell curve, right? We're all affected by like genetics and our hormones and just other factors. Like, I know if you took somebody that was my height, you know, my height, weight, and age, they could be burning a much different number, right? So that's why the metabolic testing is so important. So that way I can figure out how many calories you're actually burning. And then whether you want to gain weight or lose weight, I can make a proper estimation from there. And we can tailor portion sizes from there. Okay?
Perfect.
Yeah.
So don't be scared of the machine.
No, I honestly want to do like a live consultation. Like
you should do. Yeah, the whole analysis.
Yeah, I'm saying.
Yeah.
Maybe if you're claustrophobic, I wouldn't recommend it. But if you know, you could deal with having a mask on your face for 10 minutes,
oh,
then
no, that's good.
Give it a shot. Sure. Yeah,
but yeah, so going back to calories in, calories out, and we were talking about how it's not just about the calories, it's also about the quality of food that you're eating. Yes. And vice versa. I think it's also the same, right? Just how you were talking about, you can be eating a whole foods diet, but if you're not counting calories, you're not going to get results. Well, likewise, you can be in a calorie deficit, but if you're not eating the right food, you're also not going to get good results.
Yes, exactly. Or it could be the factor that's holding you back from seeing significant results, right? Like I always say, rice cakes and Splenda are very low in calories, but they're not really providing you with much nutrition at all. And so it's good to have that balance. We want whole foods, but portion control still plays a role.
Of course. And then the next one, I guess, would be the metabolism and just like the thermogenesis effect of different types of foods, right?
Exactly. So that's where the metabolism maintenance comes in. Because again, like I said, you can deficit your way to weight loss, but in order to maintain it, it's really important to prioritize that metabolic rate. Mm-hmm. So like I said earlier, like building that muscle, choosing those whole foods are all going to increase your metabolism, and trying to get in movement throughout the day is going to keep your metabolism like just activated and healthy. And then mindful eating is the last pillar. And mindful eating is more of the psychological part of all of this, because like I said, if we know what to eat and how much to eat, doesn't always mean that we are actually going to follow through with that. And that's where I think mindful eating can play a role. Learning when to feed your body and when your body is actually satisfied. A lot of us, when we're eating pretty quickly. We often don't recognize that we're full until we're a bit overly full, right? Like, I know sometimes after a meal, I'm like, I feel like I want to go lie down, like take a siesta. Ideally, we wouldn't be doing that. Ideally, we would want to eat to a point where we feel energized by the meal. Like, I've had a good fill and now I can go off and, you know, get on with the rest of my day rather than kind of feeling weighed down by the meal.
Getting the itis.
Yeah, no, because I had, you ever been to Rolling Smoke?
No.
The barbecue place?
No, I never been there.
Yeah. Okay, yeah, bro. I had like it was a long time ago. I had like fucking ribs, all that shit. Bro, when I got done with my meal, I thought I got stabbed. Like, I was like, my stomach, I'm like, bro, call the ambulance, man. I don't feel good. So ever since that, I wanted to ask you about mindful eating. Like, do you think there is, like a childhood, like it comes from childhood, like how we learn about mindful eating?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, we're all born mindful eaters. So I don't know if you guys have kids or if you've ever like just been around like really young kids, but when they're eating lunch, like they'll take like 3 bites of their sandwich and then they're like, okay, cool, I'm gonna go run off and play now. That's mindful eating. They're very in tune with like, okay, this is how much I need. And when you look at studies of kids and how much they're eating, they literally eat like the perfect amount for their bodies. So when parents are like, oh my God, my kid, they're not eating enough. It's like, no, your kid knows how much they need because they trust their body.
Sorry to cut you off, but they do the typical like, you ain't getting up till you finish your food.
Exactly.
That's how they get you, bro.
Yeah.
Man, I don't want to tell those stories. Here we go. I have a lot of traumatic stories with mindful eating, but
100%. I think we all probably grew up in an age where it was like, you got to clean your plate in order to like get up from the dinner table, right? Mm-hmm. So that trains us out of mindful eating. And then also like, in school, we would have to eat at a very certain time, you know, like they were like, you know, you can't have a snack unless you brought enough to share with the class. Yeah. Right.
This is bringing back so many. Yeah. Memories, see, bro. It's like we've been betrayed our whole life. Bro. Yeah. We've been set up to fail. Yeah,
exactly. So we've kind of been like almost acclimatized to, all right, you got to eat this much and you're not going to have access to food for this many hours, so you better eat your fill. And that kind of trains us out of our body and it puts us more in our head. And then diet culture kind of has an impact on that of like, oh, you're hungry? Well, you're trying to lose weight, so don't eat when you're hungry. And then that can lead to binging later on, which really sets us back. So all of these factors kind of like train us out of our body. And I think it's really important for us to try to relearn that and gain that body trust. So mindful eating is simply like eat when you're hungry, stop when you're pleasantly satisfied, try not to get to the point where you're overly full. And then also try to learn the difference between emotional hunger and biological hunger. Because sometimes our brain will trick us and you'll be like, am I hungry? But really, we're just like bored or
sad.
Maybe we're kind of stressed, right? Yeah. So there's a couple of ways that we can kind of differentiate these if you want me to kind of go into that.
Please, yes. Yeah.
Okay, cool. So emotional hunger versus biological hunger. Biological hunger is open and gradual versus emotional hunger is sudden and specific. So when you're biologically hungry, you're kind of open to various foods. Like I'd be like, oh, okay, cool. Like I'm down for like a well-rounded meal, meat, potatoes, veggies. Like that sounds good. Versus when you're emotionally hungry, it's more specific. So you're like, actually, the meat, potatoes, and veggies doesn't sound good at all. I just want the chips or I just want the ice cream. So that's a good litmus test. Be like, okay, if I'm not sure if I'm emotionally hungry or biologically hungry, I'll just say, am I open to having like a well-balanced meal right now? If not, it's probably emotional. There's something else that I could probably do to fill whatever my brain is seeking in that moment, whether it's like a dopamine spike or like just rest and relaxation. And then when you are biologically hungry, it's far easier for you to eat without distractions. It's much more pleasurable, I guess, versus a lot of times when we're emotionally eating, we typically need like some type of distraction, whether we're like on TikTok or like watching TV.
YouTube.
Yes.
Yeah, YouTube, bro. I can't tell you the amount of times I've seen someone on YouTube comment like, oh, I'm glad you uploaded. Now I can finally eat.
Oh, yeah. Because
only eat when you have something in front of you.
Which I'm like, I always thought that was weird. I'm like, I'm going to eat regardless, bro. I don't need no damn YouTube to eat, bro. I'm sorry.
But another question I had is like, I wonder who was the first person to invent snacking? Like, what was the first snack that wasn't like nutritionally good for you that someone was just like, yo, we just going to invent this because it just tastes good and we want to. Want
to
eat?
Or even like corn on the cob?
I've seen people eat cornstarch. I saw
somebody do that on TikTok the other day.
I didn't get it. I was like, "What is it?" I guess it's
Did
like.
It look good?
No, it
looked terrible.
It's powder, yeah, but I guess it's like just something to chew on. I guess I don't know.
I don't know.
But you know what's funny? I had like I don't want to tell these stories out here, but
go ahead.
Weird, like, have you ever done like something like weird with food? Like, did you have any like weird eating habits back in the day?
Nah, the weirdest thing, I guess it's not to derail again, but yeah. One of the things I was going to talk about is how I'm not sure about where you grew up because you grew up on the East Coast, but out here, like the public school system isn't the best. So like the food we was eating was like not good at all, not Papa balanced. You would eat Papa John's with like chocolate milk.
Yeah.
And it's like, bro, like what
and
are these?
A bag of hot Cheetos.
Yeah, and it's like, what, how was I ever going to succeed?
Yeah.
Bro? Like, so, but yeah, so go ahead.
No, I was going to say like when I was a kid, I used to do like, don't clown me for this. I used to eat like, you know, like the Eggos you put in the toaster?
Waffles? Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. And I put salt inside the squares.
Salt.
Like how much salt?
A lot of salt, yeah.
Dude, what?
I'm sorry. It's really a miracle I'm still alive, y'all.
Really, I won't knock it till I try it because it might be delicious.
No, knock it. Knock it. Yeah, knock
it now.
Please knock it. Yeah, I'm just letting you know.
Because your opinion is respected.
Yeah,
so.
No.
If you're like, I'm not knocking it till I try it. I'm like, I guess I should knock it till I try it. Maybe you're just like salt deficient or something. You like needed salt.
I'm not salt deficient. I just always like salt for some reason. I don't know. It's weird. Like my sister, she likes hella sweet shit. So like anytime I catch a flight with my sister, she can't get on the plane without a sweet.
Oh yeah. Mm.
So she get like some like chocolate cheesecake. I'm like, Sally, we're gonna miss the flight, bro. Please hurry up. But you know.
No, I'm definitely a sweets person for sure. Yeah. But I do feel like people either verge like more salty or sweet. So it sounds like you're more salty.
Yeah. But then it sucks too because like I feel like ever since I got out of college and then like, you know, started into the workforce, like something I do and I try to wean off of it now is like, you know, Celsius's and energy drinks. Or like a coffee. And I'm just like, bro, I'm sky high right now getting through my work day and shit. I'm like, I know this ain't good for me, bro. I got
caffeine.
Yeah, caffeine. Same shit with pot. Like, that's why I don't like drink any coffee or whatever before our podcast.
Yeah.
You
get dependent on
it. Yeah, I watch certain episodes of me like on an energy drink. I'm like, so we got our guest Emma today. She's, you know.
Uh-huh.
So for you, I think like kind of talking about, you know, energy and whatnot. And I think that almost kind of leads into like how Ozempic has really gotten popular over the last few years.
That's our next topic, the GLP-1s.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I guess like let's just kick it off. Like GLP-1, specifically Ozempic, has been all over the place. Like everybody's on it and it's like become a miracle drug that people are using to lose weight. Coming from the nutrition perspective, I guess, how effective is it really? Can people take advantage of it? Or is it something that can be overused? Is it something that isn't used enough? Or it used improperly? Like, what do you think?
Yes. So I'm actually very pro GLP-1, which surprises a lot of people because they're like, you're a dietitian. Shouldn't people try to do it the natural way? Well, having worked with a lot of people trying to facilitate weight management and kind of now understanding just how freaking hard it is, like, it's a losing battle. Like, our environment and our biology just makes it so, so hard for us. GLP-1s really can help to liberate people from the food noise that breeds a very toxic relationship with food. kind of that binge restrict cycle. I think that GLP-1s make learning mindful eating a lot easier, because what I've heard from my clients is, oh, okay, so I started on this GLP-1. Some of the effects that I've been noticing is whenever I notice my hunger, it's more of a nudge and not like an all-out roar. And I'm like, okay, so you're noticing your hunger cues then. That's a mindful eating practice that I try to teach my patients. And then they say, and then when I'm eating, I'm able to tell when I'm like satisfied with the food and I feel like very little desire to eat more. And I'm like, that's mindful eating. You're stopping when you're satisfied rather than overly full. And so it makes mindful eating a lot easier to master, because mindful eating, it's a practice, right? And it sounds simple, but it can be very challenging to kind of unlearn the things that have been drilled into us our entire lives. And so I do think that it can be helpful for that. Is there a risk for abuse? 100%. Yeah, people are using it and they are just not prioritizing their health. They are losing weight, but they're losing weight in an unhealthy way. And I've met with people that they come to me and they said, Emma, I've lost a ton of weight on this medication. I'm at a point where I have to get off of it. My insurance won't cover it anymore, or my A1C is too low. And I'm used to having like a protein shake and a bag of Cheetos a day, and I don't want to regain the weight. And I'm like,
you're cooked.
Well, this is going to be a pretty complex process for us, because when you do get off, like, you need to realize that like the risk for weight regain is there. I actually, in my practice, we do prescribe GLP-1s for certain clients if we think that it will be beneficial for them and they have like the proper medical history for it. But we also make sure that they meet with us regularly over a 6-month period, so that way while they're losing the weight, they're actually still getting the nutrition that they need to support their metabolism. They are implementing the lifestyle changes that they need in order to sustain the weight loss for the long term, and building their competence in mindful eating so that when they get off of the medication, they really can sustain the weight loss. So that's our GLP program. It's like a 6-month program, and people have seen a lot of success with it.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, because when we were talking about the gut microbiome, how, you know, if you're not where you need to be, it might take 3 months to get right. Yeah. I'm assuming the metabolism is roughly or on a similar timeline. So you would imagine if you're eating a protein shake and a bag of chips a day and you get off the medication, you're going to crash. You're not even going to be able to do anything for 3 months minimum. So you're going to gain all the weight back. That's going to make you more depressed. You're going to get cortisol, and then you're going to be more stressed. You're not going to sleep. You're going to eat worse food because you're craving. And it's like, it's just a mess, right? You spiral, and then there's no hope for you.
Absolutely. Well, there is hope for you, but absolutely. It's like, it's all connected, right? So, that's why, you know, weight loss, it has to be done strategically. We can't just like inject ourselves with a medication and just, you know, recklessly lose weight. Why would you want to lose weight just to gain it all back?
Because I want to look good for now. Pool season, shit.
I just need 3 months.
Need 3 months. I swear to God, please.
Like, I'm just trying to slim down for this vacation.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Rest of y'all work from home. I can care less.
Like, one thing I used to do in college, like, and my sister would get on me about this, she'd be like, if I had a test and like the score would be uploaded, whatever, because, you know, Blackboard or whatever, or Canvas, whatever it was, like, you know how you get that notification, it's like
final grade updated scores.
I'm like, oh shit, fuck, goddamn, right? So then, like, if the score was good, I would eat to celebrate, and then if the score was bad, I would eat to cope.
Yeah, totally.
What is that called, though? Like, the actual term for that.
Mental illness?
I would say that's just textbook emotional eating. And, you know, food, there's certain things in our society that we use to help cope with our emotions. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times, like, these are very, like, dopamine spiking activities. It's no wonder that we probably all in some way struggle to regulate drugs, alcohol, gambling, shopping, food. Right? Those are just some of the examples of things.
You're probably don't worry.
Yeah,
I
no, yeah.
Like, these are the things that make us feel good short term. And so whenever we are experiencing, like, really intense emotions, we haven't been taught how to really regulate them at all. And so the easy things in our society to go to kind of numb us out is, you know, like alcohol, drugs, food, gambling, shopping, social media, like all of these things that just kind of help us to disconnect from reality and disconnect from our bodies. So the antidote to that is learning how to regulate your emotions in a healthy way. So some of these might be, you know, self-soothing strategies, learning, incorporating things into our day-to-day that help us to relax, that help us to get a sense of fun or enjoyment, a sense of pleasure, or just simply a little dopamine spike, right? So,
just a little bit of liquor.
Everything in moderation.
Yeah, in moderation. but no, seriously though, like, with all that being said that we've been talking about for, like, you know, the last hour, like, when, like, is someone who is watching this episode or who wants to start their you know, their weight loss journey, like, when should they know when to reach out to a dietitian or to a registered professional?
That's a great question. You know, I think that if they are just feeling kind of lost, they would like some more tailored direction. If they've tried a bunch of measures in the past and they haven't worked out, maybe they just need a little bit of guidance. I always tell people, like, I'm never going to tell you anything that's going to blow your mind. Like, I'm not going to be like, this is the secret, guys. These are the keys to weight loss, right, that nobody knows about. Like, we all kind of know what to do, but there's so much misinformation out there. There's, like, so much in the nutritional zeitgeist that sometimes it's hard to know, like, what is the best course of action. And again, it's highly individualized. So meeting with a dietitian can just help you to form a more tailored and structured plan.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. No, that's good to know. And one other thing I had too is just, like, I don't know if you've traveled internationally, but all of us have. And, like, what I noticed was like, because I just came back from Japan in March, like,
subtle flex.
Oh, yeah, regular. But even, like, I would eat like shit over there. Like, I would eat McDonald's and I wouldn't feel like shit.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? Like, or just like the food, the quality of food over there is just so much higher compared to America. So when I, like, why is it so hard to, like, make good choices in America versus other countries?
Well, I always tell my clients, we have to be extra careful about our food choices because we don't live in a country where they really prioritize our health, mm-hmm, and wellness, and our food system, you know? And, like, this is, like, a very complicated discussion to get into, like, how we can start to undo that. But I think just trying your best to educate yourself and find access to affordable, healthy food. Really get knowledgeable about the things in your ingredient list and learn, what are the ones that are okay? What are the ones that are not going to have as much of an effect? And what are the ones that in excess are really going to do some damage to me metabolically? I think that education is essential. Because, yeah, our, you know, our food system, it's really not built for our health in mind. It's built to make a profit.
Right. And one more question I had too, like how you were speaking about getting knowledge, like how do we know what's like legit and not legit on the internet? Because like for most people, they might, you know, watch a TikTok or now it's like, oh, ChatGPT. How do I lose weight and get like a PDF list, you know?
That's a really great question. You know, this is where I think meeting with a dietitian can be very valuable, because I think what having a really strong education in this has allowed me to do is I can see something and go, oh, that's not right. Like I think that, you know, when you have kind of a deeper understanding of nutrition, you're like able to navigate through that a little bit easier. Like, you know, with accounting, I'm sure if I like read something that somebody presented in a really specialized way, I'd be like, oh yeah, that makes sense. But you'd be like,
nah, this is bullshit.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. You know, just because you have that deeper level understanding of it.
No, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, but for everybody that is at home that did it, hopefully everybody profited and was able to benefit from the information that we shared. For those that do want to get in touch and do want to make a healthy change in their life and make sure that it's not just a temporary 3-month pool season change, but a long-term change.
Yeah.
How do they get in contact with you?
Yeah. So our website, www.desertdietitians.com. You can book a consultation with me or one of the other dietitians. On Instagram, we are at Desert Dietitians, and I am at @DesertDietitians_Emma. And yeah, we have an office. It's located in Las Vegas, 8560 Southeastern Avenue, Suite 100.
Perfect. And do they have to be in Vegas in order to benefit from some of the services you offer?
No. So we do telehealth as well. So I'm licensed in Arizona and Utah and Colorado and North Carolina right now.
North Carolina, that's gross.
Yeah, kind of random.
Yeah, but y'all heard it there, man. There's no excuse. There's, what, 2 more good months of pool season? So you might not make it next year.
Yeah. Ready for next
year. Gonna make a change. Yeah, let them know they can follow you guys on social media.
Oh, I'll go first. Y'all can follow me at @N2DATK on all your favorite social media platforms.
Sure.
Follow me on Fredo's Fix, all platforms.
Go ahead and follow the podcast. Instagram page is going to be onarun.pod. Make sure you're following our YouTube, TikTok, where we upload all the shorts, all the clips. Make sure you like, comment, subscribe, and we'll be back next week with another episode. Peace.